Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. You are listening to Love in the 21st Century. We are on every Tuesday from 5 to 6. Tonight, it's hosted by myself, Tamara, and Adam Mose. We are talking about love in the 21st century. It's a talk show with live call-ins, interviews, and discussions on the philosophical to the practical look of love, from romantic relationships to connections with humanity. One-third dating insights, one-third self-love guide, one-third compassion training. And we are going to be talking about spiritual love. We're going to be continuing on our conversation we've been having the last few weeks before we change it up. So we get to hear Mr. Mose's perspective. And remember, this is a call-in radio show. So if you have anything to add, a personal story, a question, anything you'd like to share on the air, give us a call. The number's 895-1114. That'll get you on the air. And for now, we're going to send you off with something to get you in the mood. Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by one of Chico's newest restaurants, Rollo's West, at 234 West 3rd Street in the heart of downtown. Rollo's West offers small and large plates, Maryland-style shrimp, blue crab cakes, a wine bar, charcuterie, and artisanal cheeses. Rollo's West is open from 5 till 9 p.m. until 10 on Friday and Saturday. For more information, visit them on Facebook or by calling 636-4468. Love in the 21st Century. Here we are talking about love and spirituality. Spiritual love. Thank you, Adam, for being here.
My pleasure.
And we're going to get into the conversation. Remember, folks, this is a call-in radio show, so feel free to join the conversation by dialing 895-1114. You can always message us on the Facebook page as well, and we'll do our best to get those questions on the air as well.
So some folks would say, like, any sort of love, any flavor that it comes in, it's divine. You know, it's the thing that always works to make the situation more enriched, especially if it's coming from a non-grasping place. This idea of loving, you know, my orientation is from the Buddhist lineage. And we have this, like, simple definition, like the love is wanting the other's happiness and engaging in actions and having the attitude about just that, you know. And then when it's coming from that place and you're able to put it into effect directly, we can say there's more love in the world. So I wanted to talk, you know, in general about love, but also how in the Buddhist lineage, you know, in my training that I have, we go about cultivating it, because it is something that we're naturally born with. Each baby we ever see is like the perfect love generator. People see the baby and they're like, what? More love comes out naturally. So we all have that capacity for loving naturally. But then it's like there's certain extra trainings, extra expectations, whatever it is, bumps in the development that it seems like it's hard to get back to. But like the baby generates the love, but it doesn't have the capacity to really put it into effect. I love playing with the little toddlers and the two-year-olds, and with when they're in a loving environment, they're raised by loving parents, they have this natural little game. They hand you something, like playing with something, immediately hand you it. I got it. Now I hand it back. And it's like, oh, we just had a game. This is something, you know, that feels fun to do, this little exchange. And but that's about the extent of it. Then as we mature, we get more capacity, you know, like we have more. I can even drive a car now. I couldn't do that at all when I was toddling around. But, you know, with that car, I can do fantastic loving things. I can take people to the airport, you know, when they need to go, etc. So it's this thing of now we have this fully matured capacity. We still got to remember and generate consciously our capacity for loving others. And from my lineage, I'm saying it's possible. It's not impossible. It's like one of my dear spiritual friends who was raised in this awful situation. He was taken out of his family, abusive family situation, when he was 3 and raised in orphanages and then gangs. When I met him, the most beautiful, loving guy. And he hadn't gone, you know, to any like love classes or whatever, but had taken it upon himself to develop this. So it's not impossible. In fact, we're saying, you know, it's essential. We really, you know, like if we want to have a world that's got more love in it, what we need to do is love more. And the only one who can love is oneself, you know. That's the only bit of area that I have a genuine say over.
I feel like that what you're leading to naturally begets the question, well, then how does one cultivate more love, especially under, you know, extenuating circumstances, like you were explaining your friend, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some insight that you want to share about that?
Yeah, well, there's the many different ways, many, many different ways. And the first thing is, because Buddhism, we very much approach this from a rational point of view, from an intelligent point of view, and even one might say a logical point of view. And that almost seems contradictory. How can we logically produce love. So, you know, it's like in the Western philosophy, love is supposed to be this emotional, you know, almost crazy thing we do in the spring. It takes you away from your logical mind. I know I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do it because I love it. That's not the kind of, you know, it's part of it, but it is possible to explore this beautiful worldview. I love Buddhist philosophy, and people say it's not even a religion. You know, obviously it's a major world religion, but how I've encountered it, it's always a philosophy, and you're supposed to be able to think it through yourself and apply it and let it be a path. You know, it's like something that you walk in the life. So the life experiences were part and parcel with the learning that happens. So we're saying there's certain ideas which have very much made a lot of inroads into West Coast culture, modern culture even. When we talk about karma, people immediately have an idea of what that is. And they think, first off, bad karma. You know, you say, oh, that's karma. It means something bad happened. But if something good happens, also, that's karma. Karma in the Buddhist definition just means action. And that for every action, there's an equal opposite reaction. That all the actions that come to us come from earlier actions that we have taken. So, in that sense, we have a say in what sort of world we're building for ourselves. You know, that the positivity that I'm putting out, then it comes back somewhere down the road in different ways. And it's very universal. People just have an understanding of that, what karma is. But then how to be specific and very creative with it, it just shows that, you know, if I want a more abundant scene, then I'm being more generous. If I want a more peaceful scene, then I'm being more peaceful. So from that, obviously, you know, the more everyone wants the love in the world, wants the love in their life. So then it would make sense. We want to cultivate for being more loving. So part of this is like building up the motivation, like why it's a really good thing to consider as real and important and to put some effort into. It's like as much as I'm going to go to the gym and get big muscles, I could work on my love lifting. And develop that and cultivate that when I see the value of it, then it's something that I'm going to want to put in the effort to develop.
So that seems pretty simple and straightforward to apply that which you're seeking, that which you're wanting the other to present or the environment to present to display that yourself.
Yeah.
I might say that's easier said than done.
Why is that?
Yeah,
why is that? Because there's the intention, there's the motivation, and then there's the putting into action. And it seems like between those two, like the willpower part of it, we want to engage our full intention and willpower. But then it goes away. It's like, oh man, I'm getting all pissy again. Just like how my dad would have in this situation. Because that's what I had modeled to me unconsciously, you know, for all those years that dad was my ultimate role model. Or mom, or aunt, or uncle, or whoever. Like how the family dynamic would work. Or not work, you know?
I would even possibly say that they're not necessarily the role model. Because, I mean, role model, I guess, kind of in my mind, insinuates this term of someone you look up to, as much as it's the person you spend the most time with. And one of the things that I've learned is that you start to take on the traits of the six people you spend the most time with.
Yep.
So you should choose those six people pretty wisely.
That's right.
And so it's interesting, you know, it's not necessarily always people that we admire that we're taking on their qualities, but it's just that time thing that, like, that unconscious acceptance of their behaviors, their beliefs, and attitudes. We don't think about that, we're just, you know, around them, but it's like seeping in somehow that it's an acceptable way to be in the world. And unless you're consciously becoming aware of your choices in each of those moments, then you're, in a sense, destined to become more like those six people.
So keep that in mind, kids. You can pick your friends, and you can pick your nose, but you can't pick your friend's nose.
No.
Okay, that didn't make a lot of sense.
It didn't, but that's okay.
Yay, I've stopped making sense.
Yes. Adam, we're here for you to make sense.
Okay, I'll continue to do that then.
Awesome. Thank you.
About the Sangha. The way that Buddhism is considered a religion is that the philosophy, the practice of it, becomes a refuge. It becomes a place, safe haven, and a positive direction. It's like, within this context, good things are going to come. I can feel safe here. I can feel at home. You're saying, like, those six friends, your community, in a way, it becomes your refuge, you know, and it depends on what you're choosing, how you want to configure that. So the first step of becoming a Buddhist officially, with the little quotation marks in the air, you know, I was a practicing Buddhist, I tried meditating, I was attending teachings, you know, I had relationships with masters, quite in-depth practices going on for many years. And then I wasn't officially considered a Buddhist. And then I did this little practice called the refuge-taking ceremony. And it was very meaningful. It was very beautiful. And you take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And it's fascinating that those are all equal. From the time of the Buddha, all three of those were considered equally important. So your community and who you're associating with, that 100% has such a profound effect on how you're going to develop. So in the Buddhist context, we call that Sangha. And it's always good to keep company with the wise. If you're able to keep company with the wise, your wisdom will develop. If you're hanging with the loving folks, your loving will naturally develop. So that's another real simple one. It rubs off on you. And it doesn't always have to be congenial. This was another interesting thing. From the Zen part of it, like when you're all practicing together, you know, if you're practicing meditation together, you're practicing the path together, then it's like you rub up against each other. They called it like the sack of potatoes sangha. I'm a little dirty, you're a little dirty, but we rub up against each other and we rub off the dirt just gradually, just by being together and in the same sack, bumping around. And I always loved that image. It's kind of like, you know, just hanging and being with the people. Why community? We were talking last time, why community? It has love in it is because we're going to bump up against each other and see, you know, how we can bring out the best part of each other, you know, in that contact. So then, you know, if we're really talking about cultivating it intentionally, we have to have that working definition. It's just wanting the other's happiness. And we we cut out all of the other, you know, fantastic, because love is a many splendored thing, and the poetry and the music, it's just endless. What, how people experience it and describe it, it's so many different things for so many different people, and I can't knock that. That's so important. But then for its practical cultivation, we have to simplify it. So we're just going down to this nuts and bolts thing of saying, it's wanting the other's happiness, it's working for the other's happiness, putting their happiness, one might say, even before one's own, which is a big one. It always pushes buttons.
Yes.
People are like, we're in the self generation, the me generation. Of course, you have to love yourself first.
Right.
Before you love another. But once you got yourself fully loved up, the genuine expression of love is to go ahead and love the other. And one of my wacky spiritual friends, he always called me the brother of other. Because I always emphasize, it is, we have to think about the other. And that's the remedy, in a way, for the me, 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 me focus. Always the me, 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 me cherishing focus.
Right. It leads me to wonder, though, in the direction of, if we're talking about loving of the other in like a greater sense, so not like necessarily just the other in the partnership, but like other in community being much larger, like a city or a nation or a world.
Yep.
And loving the other when the other is doing things that may be destroying.
Yep.
Literally their ability to live and the rest of the world's ability to live.
That's right.
Finding the love for that. So can you speak a little bit more to
absolutely
loving them?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Loving their actions or whatever.
Right. Well, it's goes together. We were also talking about the love being a boundless state. It's something that can always be perfected greater and greater. It's like the extent to which I'm loving now, it can still improve. It can always get better. And the effort, the abiding in that state, always can improve. Similarly, with compassion, joy, and equanimity, there are these four, it's a package deal. Love happens to be one of them. We could do a whole other radio show on compassion, on joyfulness, and equanimity. But from the Buddhist perspective, they all go together. And sometimes, like, we want to love these others who are supposedly destroying the planet, but our love can't reach them. They have their own obstacles. They're operating under false pretenses. They're thinking of a tree as timber, as a resource, whatever. They have to extract it as fast as they can. You know, they're looking at it much differently than how the squirrel looks at it. It's my home, squirrel says. He's like, no, it's, you know, footyards. It's planks and potential profits. So we have all these different karmic visions. The way we look at the world comes through our karmic perspective, our situatedness. And these others who are in these situations where they have to see things in this very limited way, they deserve our compassion. Sometimes compassion is a swift kick in the rear end. That is what is going to be compassionate for them.
But what is that compassion?
That is the type of compassion. It's happened to me at different times in the past. And it's what I needed to get me through this limited karmic vision that I was imposing on other people in other situations.
So are you, so to get this clear for myself, so you're saying like a strong reprimand for one's choices, actions, consequences on the rest.
Yeah.
Is like the swift kick.
Yeah.
Is that's the reference to it? So
right.
That's like the tough love.
Yeah.
Kind of component. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And when we were saying how karma is flawless,
mm-hmm.
It's like gravity. You know, it is automatic. There's no one arbitrating karma. It's just happening. So all the things that they're perpetrating are going to come back to them. Planet rapers, you know, ultimately are sowing the seeds of future misery. If you can, you can get in there and limit that, you know, with the love for them, with the compassion for them. And this also fits in with the view of rebirth. All these systems I take for granted, but I need to communicate from the Buddhist perspective. There's a mind, there's a body. When the body finishes, the mind continues. And it's been doing that beginninglessly. That's my first book I'm writing about, beginninglessness. Because it's such, we are so fixated on beginnings and beginning mythologies in the West. Every Western philosophy or religion has its origin myths. Oddly enough, Buddhism doesn't worry about that. There's just been rebirth. And because of this infinite, infinite amounts of rebirths, at one time or another, each, every being has been your own mother and shown you tender kindness. I love that part of it. That is the all my relations part of it. When Native Americans say all my relations, they're meaning how they feel connected, related to all the beings. That's built into the Buddhist perspective, because we've been taken rebirth so many, so many times. In a past life, I was your mom. You were my mom. When you have that attitude towards the little ant, you know, crawling on the sink, I can't be so brutal.
Absolutely.
With the little ant.
I can feel definitely a softening, like you, of what you're explaining. Just the idea of viewing people I have challenges with as if they were my mother.
Yeah.
Just doesn't, it doesn't feel as easy to just be upset.
That's right.
You're like, oh, sorry, Mom.
Yeah.
You almost want to apologize to them for being upset.
All we have to offer them is respect and an attempt to repay their kindness. Because
mm-hmm.
mothers did so much in so many lives to support our life. And to you know, like they sacrificed things for themselves to give us the best start that we possibly can get. So, you know, it's gratitude and respect and this wanting to pay it back, and adopting that feeling, then all the victim role, the kind of victim thing that we can get ourselves into, goes away. That is what's empowering. Why? To develop the attitude of love, compassion, joyfulness, equanimity, you need to just dispense with the victim role, putting yourself in a victim role, and how that's a natural byproduct of this worldview.
Mm-hmm. Very profound, very helpful in how we can view differently the challenges that are in front of us. Not something I'd ever heard before about Buddhism, so thank you for enlightening us with that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah.
And it's just a little tip of the iceberg. I'm doing it in all my kind of westernized ways. But one of my most incredible, like, living Buddha masters is coming from India to little Chico, not next week, but the week after, and giving teachings at Sky Creek Dharma Center on Thursday night. This is July the 7th. His name is Chamtrul Rinpoche.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, why we went to Dharamsala, my family and I, we went to Dharamsala 2 years ago and lived there for a month and had teachings from him every day. Amazing. Mm. So amazing. He's so precise. He's so profound. And travels the world now. And somehow, blessed as we are, little Chico is on his world tour.
Beautiful.
So there's information about that on the Sky Creek Dharma Center website, skycreekdharmacenter.org, I think. And or we could do a link.
Absolutely. On our Facebook page, Love in the 21st Century, we can put a link to the event happening on Thursday the 7th.
Yep. And then you get, you know, the authentic. I'm doing like a rough approximation.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good intro for on the air. So thank you, Adam. Okay. So spiritual love and the context. We'll be talking more here in a moment with Adam Mose. If you want to call in with any questions, feel free to give us a call. Or if you just have something to share, 895-1114. We like to talk to new people all the time. Welcome back to Love in the 21st Century, talking with Adam Mose about spiritual love, a very thought-provoking conversation per usual here on Love in the 21st Century. And remember, you can be part of that conversation by calling 895-1114. So where did we leave off there, Adam?
We were loving everybody.
Loving everybody. There's a good practice to adopt.
And looking at all the other beings as having at one time or another been your own mother.
Yes.
And giving you that type of unconditional love and support. So that does away with the victim mentality.
Mm-hmm.
These are our mothers. They're confused. They're engaging in stuff that is at cross purposes to their own happiness sometimes.
Yes.
That's greater deserving of our compassion.
Yes. I just laugh because I think about like me looking at others as my mother and then thinking about them as being confused, because if I explain that to somebody, I think they might think I was a little bit confused. But
when we look at this idea of a body taking rebirth,
absolutely,
a mind taking a rebirth, it never having an onset. It's
mm-hmm.
like if I had one rebirth, then I had one before that, then mm-hmm. I had one before that, and one before that. And each of those rebirths, I had a mother.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that's infinite mothers.
Absolutely. It's
How many
human
beings are there in the universe? Infinite.
Infinite amount, absolutely. And I also have this feeling like I'd just be like making this really funny face at people and like wanting to squeeze their cheeks, because my mom has a really cute face, and so I was always like you're so cute. So I'm gonna start adopting this, Adam, so expect me to be looking at you like I want to squeeze your cheeks.
Okay, you can squeeze my cheeks.
So where do we go from here?
Then we're talking about like spiritual love.
Mm-hmm.
Then the attitude of wanting to be generous, open out with your contact, with what you have to offer to the other. It's this natural flow, you know, like the mothers have that with the kids. There's just that the generosity they don't have to think about. We want to be able to try to cultivate that with all the other folks. We want to open out and give them what they need in a timely way. So this idea of generosity being the first virtue that very naturally wants to get developed in our development of love. And this is also, I think, some wisdom from the Native American tradition. They're saying, like, if you have a problem with someone and you want to try to patch it up with them, you offer them a gift. You know, really make something that's going to be suitable, appropriate for them, and offer it. And then it's harder for you to be mad at this person if you go ahead and give a gift. And we have, like, these specific times during the year where we can give gifts. It's all, you know, like, expected in a way. Christmas and birthdays, you know. So I always had a hard time with that. Gift is, like, who you are and what you're showing up with, you know, just in the moment. What's there. And the sensitivity is the understanding of persons from their own side, what's going to be the most appropriate gift? What's the timely way to offer it? So that it's like, oh yeah, that's perfect. That's just what we needed. And it uplifts. So creative gift giving and just general generosity as an attitude. That's our first virtue that we encounter when we're thinking about developing a real higher love, a spiritual love. And then from the Buddhist point of view, it's like if someone's hungry and you can offer them food, that is a wonderful gift. It has this short-term benefit, though. If someone is fearful, they have mind wrapped around self-made anxieties, and you can offer them a little fearlessness. You can offer them a safe refuge to calm themselves and look at the situation more clearly. That's a wonderful gift as well. You give the gift of fearlessness. Then they're saying the highest gift is Dharma. This is one of the other jewels. One of the three jewels. We're talking Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Dharma just means truth. The way things actually are. What's real?
I wish people could see your body language.
I like to get into it. It's like that. It's like what we have to work with. Dharma, from the Hindu tradition, because Buddha was in India, at the height, one of the high spiritual apexes of the planet, 360-something BC, was an amazing time on the planet. The Greeks were blowing it up with Pythagoras and the thinkers who laid the foundation of Western thought. In China, there was Taoism and Confucianism was blowing up. Like, this was an amazing age to be on the planet. And in India, the Hindu culture was at its apex, in a way. And they had an understanding of Dharma as one's duty. Like, in the Hindu tradition, they talk about Dharma as like your, almost like your lot in life, what it is you're supposed to do in life. But Buddha was saying Dharma is like this path, and it's also the truth and the way that you can live your life in a way that approximates and moves you closer to what actually is. And the more we accord with what is, the easier it becomes. That's the thing. If I have less filters and prejudices, that I'm looking through, then my interactions with others get smoother. So the Dharma is like this, not necessarily an additive process. Like, we're getting more real, getting more basic through the practice. And from that, we understand how to conduct oneself in a moral way, in a way that has the least bit of harm. That was like the first bit, is like, do no harm. Especially, like, I practice the Chinese medicine, and the first thing of medicine is do no harm, And then, of course, whenever possible, be of benefit. Like, that's the icing on the cake. The delicious cake is being harmless, And if we as a culture, as a species, could get more
harmless
satisfaction with being harmless, things would be a lot smoother. Just would be easy. So I have this, enlightenment first. When I came back from India in my 20s, instead of earth first, I was enlightenment first. If everyone woke up, all these other problems would, of a nature, subside. Why there's the inequality in the culture, why there's the degradation of the environment. All these things come from the mistaken perceptions and actions of the individuals that make it up. So offer Dharma. That's a great generosity. All this is like getting to the point where we offer, and then what do we keep? What do we hold? I hold the harmlessness. And that's like my guide, my moral compass. It might feel good, it might be something, that's been modeled to me in media or whatever. But if it's going to harm another, then I'm going to curtail that. I'm going to stop it. So we're giving generously, keeping morality. And It's something internal. It's not a morality that someone can say, oh, I can do this, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. Very interestingly, mm-hmm. in Buddhism, there's five precepts, which are just, they're called like the vows of training. They're like training wheels, you know. I undertake the vow of training to abstain from taking life. Because every creature, it always wants to have its own life continue. Great or small, every being always wants its own life to continue. So taking life, obviously, as a natural cause, you have a karmic production from that. I undertake the vow of training to abstain from taking what's not mine, from stealing. Because everyone likes their own stuff and be able to use it when they want. I undertake the vow of training to abstain from lying, false speech, or harsh speech, or frivolous speech, meaningless, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Ways in which, you know, I can muddy the water with my speech. But we are saying that these aren't like thou shalt nots, in the sense that if I can save a life by telling a lie, a white lie, you know, the classic one is I'm out relaxing, meditating in the woods, and I see the deer leap across the clearing. Oh, how lovely. And then the hunter comes out, you know, he's got his full thing on, the rifle going. He's like, okay, which way did the deer go? I can very plainly say, you know, pointing the wrong direction, that way, he went that way, and saved the life of the deer. So I told a lie, but ultimately, karmically, didn't hurt the gentleman, might have helped the deer a whole bunch. So the morality gets to be your own. It's your own. It's how you have your own compass, your own guide, and it's guided by your feelings, your emotions. This thing of valuing the emotions, the feelings, and understanding that they'll be there to guide you intelligently. There's no conflict between head and heart. Like mm-hmm. the mind in Buddhism, interestingly also, as well as in Chinese medicine, it's in the heart. Mind, they say, it's like in the blood, and the heart is in charge of the blood. So heart is like where the mind is. And then when we think of heart, we think of love. Mm-hmm. Well, it always goes together.
Yeah. I think there, for many people out there, myself included, there can be quite the spectrum to the harmlessness mm-hmm. and the view of what one considers to be harmful mm-hmm. or not. And so it really requires quite a bit of conscious awareness around our actions.
That's right. And we aspire to it, and we understand that it's practically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
The Jains is another religion of India around the time of the Buddha, and they have the principle of ahimsa, mm-hmm. which is harmlessness. That's the Sanskrit word for it. Ahimsa is harmlessness. And if you're a really devout, good Jain, you pretty much like almost die of being harmless. Because being a biological organism on the planet, you still have to eat. And even if you're a vegetarian, then the farming process kills a lot of critters. So I think of it like the good, the actions, the positivity that I'm going to generate from the meal, may it outweigh the suffering that went into bringing it to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like this bottom line bit. that if I move my car around, I'm going to kill bugs.
Right.
And but the way that I'm going and what I'm going to do when I get there, the positivity of that may it off weigh, you know,
right.
counterbalance that. So we can't get obsessive compulsive about harmless.
Right.
But bringing more of a conscientious to that is just wonderful.
It brings the thought to mind about how one perceives their own harmlessness versus how the other perceives their harmlessness. And so I'm happy that you pointed out not going into the obsessive compulsive idea about it, because in reality, the other can perceive something to be harmful,
yeah.
whether the intent is to be harmful or not. And so yeah. really being clear about what your own intent is
mm-hmm.
and being aware of from that perspective, but not to the point that it paralyzes you from action.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It's a lot of work right there.
No, it gets easier as you go along. And that's why we have meditation.
Right.
Why there's the development of calm abiding and the clarity that comes from a peaceful mind, you know, to be able to sort through all this stuff at the moment level, you know. It just helps if you have a quiet mind and it's more directly with what's going on.
Absolutely. What you're sharing reminds me of what I've heard in the past about meditation. It's why it's been called a practice.
Right.
Because it's something you have to do continuously and consciously. It's not something that at a certain point you've mastered and get better at it and it mm-hmm. evolves, but it's something that you continuously put your energy into and practice, so that in those tenuous moments in life mm-hmm. when they present themselves, you can approach them in the conscious aware place that you would like to
yeah.
rather than maybe the reactive habitual pattern.
I always love that when the Dalai Lama, they ask him, you know, how's your practice? He's like, oh, it's not so good. It could stand some improvement, you know.
Yeah. It's supportive and helpful for the rest of us.
Right?
Yes. If even the Dalai Lama shares his practice in such a way. Mm.
So then there's this whole other wonderful thing of samsara and nirvana. These are two other really big ideas that we have in Buddhism. And samsara is like a perfume, and nirvana was a rock band from Seattle. But before all those, before it got co-opted by the mainstream, there was these beautiful guiding ideas. And samsara is this thing we're saying, like obsessive compulsive, or this thing of compulsion, like I can't stop. I mean, I'm going too fast and it's just going on this autopilot thing. How do I stop? I can't see how. And on, this closed loopedness was one of the first ways that the idea of samsara really became real. And this is also kind of like this revelation. Everyone's like, oh, I'm going to be reborn again, so it's cool, you know. I have this life, it's going to finish, and then my mind's going to continue to take another rebirth. Booyah, you know, I get to live forever, kind of. I'm like, yeah, but each time we're always forgetting, we're not able to build upon all the stuff, everything that we had, all those karmas that we made. It's the very stuff of this next life we're going to enter into. And there's no guarantee it's going to be higher. There's this idea in the New Age circles, like each rebirth you keep evolving conscious until you ascend, and it's going up like that necessarily. Not necessarily, you know, based on the karma, based on one's perspective and the net effect, you know, of your actions. That's the stuff of the future. So it's the extensiveness of it, the unstoppability of it, which gets scary. Like the rebirth, 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 rebirth. uncontrollably, then samsara is like this place where people screw up of a very nature. That's the nature. So there's this thing of the development of patience. That we're all in this together, but we haven't been given a good instruction book. We're not playing, you know, necessarily fair, everyone being fair. So there's going to be folks messing up. And it's not personal. They're messing up here or there. But when they do that, we have this wonderful capacity then. We want to develop our genuine spiritual muscles. That means forgiveness, forbearance, patience. I can talk about these things, but if you want to see someone who can really embody these things, please come and see Chomchul Rinpoche Thursday after next. Amazing, amazing being. I mean, you get it. You know, this guy's really embodying it. I'm just talking about it. He's walking it.
So come to Sky Creek Dharma Center.
Yep.
On the 7th of July, and meet him and see him and listen to him speak. I've had the privilege of sitting with him in the past, and he is all that Adam claims and more.
Yay.
So check it out. Ecotopia is coming up next with Stephen and Susan Schutte. They discuss environmental issues with nationally renowned authors and activists. EcoTalk, it's your local link to a global network of folks who know and care about the health of our planet. Thank you so much for tuning in to Love in the 21st Century. We'll be back with you next Tuesday. And stay tuned for Ecotopia. It will be a worthy, interesting conversation. No matter if you are a gardener, a farmer, a rancher, a landscaper, an architect, a teacher, a student, a business owner, someone who wants to create a conscious project, anyone who cares about creating restorative systems that take care of the earth and of human settlements, bringing us all towards a more sustainable future, will benefit from the internationally recognized Permaculture Design Certification Course in Chico, California. It will open doors in creating more sustainable and regenerative business communities, habits, and lifestyles. Permaculture is an ecological design science that mimics natural systems that thrive on their own, and it does this through integrating methods and techniques through design. That means that by working with nature instead of against nature, we use biomimicry to copy what natural systems do best. Thrive. Creating natural systems, house systems, economical systems, social systems, agricultural systems. In this 72-hour internationally recognized certification course, you will learn principles of permaculture, sectors and zones, patterns in nature, climate, water, soil, design methods, community, eco-village design, creating change, creative problem solving, what it is to be a designer, and more. This is the third local permaculture design certification training. It's coming up this fall, 4 weekends in October and November, so that everyone can still follow through with their other obligations and participate too. We have discounted positions for students and faculty, and also early bird prices and group prices. Keep an eye on the website for more details. www.perma-fun-k.com. We really care about making this certification accessible to all the community members, so we are bringing early bird discounts through June, so that everyone can save their spot with a $250 deposit and pay for the rest of the course during the training. That way, you can prepare yourself for this certification with plenty of time without losing work or study days. This is a life-changing course that will put you on the right path of a personal journey towards regenerating this earth, your family, and the community around you. What are you waiting for? Go to www.perma-fun-k.com. Okay.
This is FM.